Harvard for Hall. She got her PhD in Amsterdam, then did postdocs at IBM Watson Labs and Caltech. Then she was a research staff member at IBM Watson for a while before moving to her current position at Okta. She's also a DBRC at PI. And today she's going to tell us about classifying Hamiltonians in terms of their computational complexity.
Okay, thanks for the introduction, Daniel. So I'm happy to be here. Decided I would talk about computational complexity that some of you may have already heard about, but I'd like to stress two things in my talk, or kind of hope that you remember two things of my talk. One is a little bit to know what is a perturbation gadget, and the second thing is to know what is a stochastic Hamiltonian. And maybe you already know these things. And so what I'd like to do in this talk is give you a bit of an overview of results of the last, 7 years or so in this area. And some of it is my own work and some of it is others' work, other people's work. And by now, a sort of a nice classification has emerged, which is by no means all done, but I think it is has a certain simplicity. And so the idea is to classify Hamiltonians in terms of their computational complexity. And you can immediately ask them, what do I mean by that? So any Hamiltonian generates some time dynamics. And of course, I could say, well, maybe one Hamiltonian is more powerful than the other in terms of the computation you can do with it, and in terms of the time dynamics that it generates. This is not quite how I want to classify Hamiltonians. This is not what I want to capture. You could also ask, we could look at the ground state of the Hamiltonian. How complex can such a ground state be? And I can have a classification in which I say, well, these Hamiltonians have, you know, similarly complex ground states than this other class. Yeah? And that is a little bit closer to what the game is here. One can also ask, which is turns out to be related, I can ask certain questions about Hamiltonians. And I can ask, how hard is it to answer these questions? For example, I can ask, I have a Hamiltonian on n spins or n qubits, and how easy or hard is it to determine the ground state energy? You know? And that latter question is the question that we actually focus on in computational complexity, the way I set it up in my talk. And this can be formalized in terms of games, which involve a Merlin and an Arthur. Okay, so that's a little bit the second half of my talk, in which I will talk about these games. But now I first want to start with classifying Hamiltonians and how we do this, you know, a little bit make contact with physics. So because, of course, Hamiltonians are our bread and butter in physics. And also physics is sort of like an onion in which we work at a certain shell. So if we do, because for example, I'm teaching a course in quantum optics at home in Aachen. And in order to do quantum optics, I don't need to go to the strong interaction between quarks. I don't need to include all the high energy physics in the nucleus. Or I don't even need to look at relativistic effects very much or describe it with quantum electrodynamics in order to describe, you know, quantum optics experiments with Rydberg atoms, say. And why not? It's because there's high energy physics that is no longer relevant that we can take out, or to the extent that it has effects, we can deal with it with the use of perturbation theory. So we have a very natural way in physics of relating Hamiltonians to each other, and particularly what we're interested in is Hamiltonians and their low energy physics, so the ground state properties, or maybe not only the ground state and its energy, but maybe a low-lying manifold of ground state, a manifold of states. So what I want to do first is to talk about perturbation theory and show you how we use this in computational complexity in a very versatile way. And we started doing this a while ago, and I think this will certainly be done much more and more systematically. And I want to tell you what the ideas are behind this. Okay, so let's imagine we're first doing it sort of the way we do it in physics, which is in one way. But let's imagine I have a Hamiltonian. not specifying many properties of it. Maybe it acts on n spins or something like that, or fermions or bosons. But it's part. It splits up in a simple part, which is called H0, and a perturbation V. And I'm interested in doing degenerate perturbation theory, which means the following. The spectrum of H0 is degenerate. There's a ground state or ground space, which has a large degeneracy. And then there's some gap. And then there is a higher lying space or more spaces. This could go on a bit. And what happens if I now, so if there's no perturbation, I have a simple spectrum like that. But this degenerate ground space, what happens if I turn on this perturbation? Then these levels that are all degenerate, they will split in energy, right? And a similar thing would happen with this with these higher spaces. So you can imagine that if this is if this degeneracy is extensive, that there will be some physics, there will be a Hamiltonian that describes the physics in this space. And there could be a Hamiltonian that describes the physics in all these levels, which I call the effective Hamiltonian that I obtain from my perturbative expansion. And so the idea is that this effective Hamiltonian, and the question is how you obtain this, this is the recipes of degenerate perturbation theory, this effective Hamiltonian will have a ground state energy which is close to the original Hamiltonian and a ground state which is close. Now, how close depends a little bit on, how large the norm is of V versus the unperturbed part. And I don't want to say too much about it, but of course, because you have to be a bit careful to talk about the convergence of such perturbative expansions. Okay, but I don't want to go into this technical subject in this talk. Okay, so like I said, I'm teaching quantum optics, and then what you do is you deal with a model like a very simple model for an interaction with an atom and a photon. So I would just want to give you a simple example of use of degenerate perturbation theory to generate an effective Hamiltonian in quantum optics. This may not be the standard way it's analyzed, but it gives you the same results, and I think it's a fairly nice way of seeing how you can use it in this case. So there is the model. So we have a model our atom as a two-level system. And so there's a Pauli Z matrix, and the energy difference between 0 and 1 is omega q. Yeah. And then we have, in addition, a one bosonic mode. For simplicity, this model only has one bosonic mode with a resonant frequency omega r. And then there's a coupling. And this is already a simplified model. This coupling is just a simple exchange of energy between the atom and the photon. Yeah, so atom decays, photon is emitted, photon is absorbed, atom is excited. Yeah, that's this term. And we're interested in describing this model for large detuning. The detuning parameter is the difference between these two frequencies. And we assume that this difference between the frequencies is much larger than this. This is called the Rabi splitting, the vacuum Rabi splitting. So that's the regime we want to be in. Now, in order to deal with this in degenerate perturbation theory, I need to write it as a Hamiltonian, which is H0, which has a large gap, plus a small perturbation V. Okay, so well, here there's a candidate for such a thing, but I actually need to rewrite this a little bit in an interaction picture. And so I actually transform the Hamiltonian such that I go to a rotating frame or interaction picture at frequency omega r for both the atom and the photon. And then this term cancels. And this term, instead of this frequency being omega q, it will now be delta. And this term doesn't change because it's unchanged under this thing. Maybe you have seen this before. OK, so the Hamiltonian I start with is of this form. I have now only the atom. And it has an energy state, the lowest state 0 and the state 1. And there is an energy splitting that is now delta. And I have my perturbation, which is of strength omega. OK, so I can apply my degenerate perturbation theory on this model. I'll come to that in the next slide. And I get, indeed, a Hamiltonian, which is an effective Hamiltonian, which is the standard way to describe the system, in which the eigenstates of the, so you hear, actually one maybe I can actually say this, that the degeneracy of this model may be clear because the atom here is in a state zero, but the state of the photon is arbitrary. It can be one photon, two photons, blah, blah, blah. These are all degenerate with respect to this term. But this degeneracy is split by this interaction. And one derives an effective Hamiltonian that looks like this. And this is what's called the lamp shift. The frequency of the atom is shifted, independent of whether actually any photons. So this also happens in the vacuum. This is just because there is an interaction with the electromagnetic field. And then there's also a shift of the atom frequency depending on how many photons there are, which is called the AC Stark shift. I just want to say, so maybe, you know, if you're familiar with this thing, you say, okay, well, that you can see how that comes out from using degenerate perturbation theory. And so there are more than one ways of doing this. And this, of course, is not a very nice topic necessary to talk about because it's kind of a technical subject. And I'd like to look at it from a conceptual way. So I don't know if people, if you say Shreve-Wolf perturbation theory, who has applied this in this way, or is it just, is this somebody that people are familiar with in this, if I say it under this? Okay. People have done adiabatic elimination. There are no quantum optics people. Okay. Because that's usually the way it's derived in the previous slide. Yeah. People have done self-energy expansions. Feynman diagrams. I mean, it's all the same. You know, there's a lot of formalism, and it's sometimes a little bit unclear, you know, what are the tricks, but there are sort of, you know, cookbooks, so to say, to derive similar results. But if we do this, want to do this in a formal way, we have to kind of make clear what the method is. Okay, so I will describe what's called Shreve-Wolf perturbation theory, which is not anything new. There are some more recent papers about it and are used in quantum information theory, but this is an old technique. And the idea is the following. I have a Hamiltonian H, which is like some matrix, and all these dots show there, you know, there's a non-zero matrix element. And this H0 is a sum of, H is a sum of an H0, which splits up in two blocks. In my case I described before, I say, well, H0 is actually very simple. There are two blocks, and inside these blocks is completely degenerate, the spectrum. But it doesn't need to be. It could be there's some, there's some non-degeneracy. So these levels do not necessarily all have to be degenerate. You know? And there's another block with these levels. So here there are two blocks. There could be also more than two blocks. You know? And added to this Hamiltonian is a perturbation. So this weak, that has to be weak compared to the energy level splitting between those two blocks. This is the important thing. And this perturbation has a block diagonal part and a off-block diagonal part. So it doesn't matter that much that it has this structure, but this is a more general form. And now the Shreve-Wolf perturbation theory is the following recipe, is to say, in order to handle this perturbation, we were going to do a unitary transformation. Now, that's the unitary transformation e to the s. So I have my Hamiltonian h. If there's e to the s, is a unitary transformation. It doesn't look unitary, but I'm taking s to be minus s dagger. I actually don't know why you put an I here and it's all Hermitian, but this is the standard way of describing it. So the goal is to find a unitary transformation, e to the s, which gives me an effective Hamiltonian such that the effective Hamiltonian is block diagonal. Yeah? And that would correspond to this picture, right? Because that this block would correspond to the what's happening over here, and this block would correspond to that level, the structure of the eigenstates over there. And the way you can, this the matrix S is actually block off diagonal. It's unique, and it can be perturbative degenerated. So S can be expanded in a derivative parameter, and then you put this in, and you make this expansion, and you solve it perturbatively. So at every order in perturbation theory, so there's a perturbative parameter in front of this V, you see what H effective is. And H effective is block diagonal, and you can go to a next order in V. so that's the recipe. And now I don't want to. So this recipe looks kind of, you know, unpleasant perhaps. But the idea of a perturbation gadget is now the following. So usually in physics, we start with H0 plus V. We start with the high energy Hamiltonian, and we want to derive the low energy effective theory. Yeah, we're just given what is this high energy physics, and we just want to apply this perturbation theory to get this low energy. In quantum information theory or computational complexity, we want to go the other way. And I'll tell you why we want to go the other way. But imagine we have a Hamiltonian target, H target, which is complicated. Now, what I mean by that is maybe a Hamiltonian which has interactions between four qubits at a time, four spins at a time, like a toric code Hamiltonian. Or it's maybe a Hamiltonian which has, for which every qubit has interactions with 10 other qubits. So the degree of every qubit is very high. Or maybe it's a Hamiltonian which is not of qubits on a two-dimensional lattice, but it has more, you know, it's on a three-dimensional system. And I would like to relate such a Hamiltonian to a Hamiltonian which is simpler. Yeah? Or it's a Hamiltonian in which I have anisotropic, Heisenberg interactions, and I'd like to relate it to a Hamiltonian in which I have isotropic Heisenberg interactions and a magnetic field. How do I do that? Huh? Now, that's the idea of perturbation gadgets. It's a tool by which you say, I have a complicated Hamiltonian, which maybe has a very interesting physics, because I've studied it, like my toric code has topological order or some other thing. But I want to know whether I could also, that physics could have arrived as a low energy physics of some other simpler Hamiltonian. This makes sense, right? Because then you say, okay, well, we want to group these Hamiltonians as, you know, there's just sort of some shell, you know, there's, I see the low energy physics, which is complicated, but I replace it with higher energy physics. And maybe there's some master Hamiltonian that will describe the whole universe, and it's, you know, it's simple, and that captures the whole class. And of course, and I also want to know that there are boundaries. Yeah? So maybe there are some Hamiltonians that say, I cannot use these gadgets to relate one to the other. So there are incompatible Hamiltonians in this way, which do not have the same computational power or computational complexity. Okay, so the point is that the only way we do this systematically is through perturbation gadgets. I don't know of any systematic method that relates Hamiltonians and their ground state energy and ground states in this versatile way. Maybe there are other tricks, but we don't know them. Non-perturbative tricks, we don't know them so well. Okay, so the goal is this. We have a target Hamiltonian, which is complicated. So we want to construct a new Hamiltonian, which is a unperturbed part, which is simple, plus a perturbation, such that the target Hamiltonian is obtained as, well, the effective Hamiltonian, but only on this P0, on this low-lying space. Yeah? So let's imagine this H0. In this picture, there's two spaces. One is the low-lying space. Here it's all degenerate. And they're called the projector on that space is P0. And then there's the high-lying space. You know? And I'm only interested in the low part, you know, in the low energy physics. So, and I say, I want to define my H0 such that this space is very degenerate. Huh? So that if I'm going to start splitting this degeneracy, I can get, you know, many, many levels, and the Hamiltonian describing the physics there, that could be my target Hamiltonian. Okay, so that's the idea of a perturbation gadget, which was originally introduced here, not using the Streiffer-Wolf theory. And I used it in 2005, and there are many, many papers that use these gadgets now. Some not always by the Streiffer-Wolf, sometimes by other perturbative techniques, but it's all the same idea. We have a target Hamiltonian, like the toric code. How do you generate that from two-body interactions? Well, there is a perturbation gadget that does that. Okay. So I want to give you one example, because you say, well, how do you get this gadget, right? I mean, you have a complicated target Hamiltonian. How you construct this H0 plus V, this looks like kind of like magic. Yeah. And you have to understand two things. One is that there are, in this gadget, there are two things that play a role. One is numbers. Like, you know, there's some perturbative expansion. There's a factor of a half and a factor of three quarters and so on. These you can't guess in advance. You just have to do the calculation. And the other one is the structure. What do you want to get? And so let me say one thing about the structure. So this is the one. This is the first gadget we did in this paper in 2005, and it's very, very simple. So I have a target Hamiltonian, which is A tensor B. And what is A and B? A acts on, say, is an arbitrary operator acting on k over 2 qubits, and B also acts on k over 2 qubits, and k is large. And I like to relate this target Hamiltonian to a new Hamiltonian that acts, in which I have terms that only act on fewer qubits. Yeah? So if I start with k is 10, and so this acts on 5 qubits, and this acts on 5 qubits, I actually want to end up with something that that acts on 6 qubits. And so I want to reduce the, so from 10 I go to 6, and then I can apply it again. From 6 I go to something lower, and eventually I reduce it to something that acts on 2 qubits at the time. Now, how do I do that? Well, I have this target Hamiltonian. Of course, this is part of a Hamiltonian with many terms, and it's quite complicated to deal with that, but we're not going to discuss this. That acts on a bunch of qubits. I'm going to define a new qubit, which I call the mediator qubit, labeled M. And my new Hamiltonian is going to, this is the high energy physics that I usually, you know, I have to throw away, but now I'm adding it to the system. My new Hamiltonian is going to be the unperturbed Hamiltonian is going to be H0 delta 1. So this mediator qubit, in its ground state, is in the state 0, and its excited state is the state 1, and that is costs you energy delta, and delta is going to be large. Yeah? And clearly, this Hamiltonian H0 is very degenerate because it doesn't make any reference to the qubits I had originally. Yeah? Those k qubits, whatever state they are, they all have the same energy, right? Because H0 doesn't make any reference to them. And now I'm going to add my perturbation. My perturbation is something that is, there's a square root of delta, so this is larger than that, and that's going to be my perturbative parameter. But it flips, it does this, it flips the mediator qubit, yeah, so it excites it or de-excites it, and at the same time it applies either minus A or plus B. You say, well, why minus A and plus B? But it will be clear. And then there is some other stuff. And this is typical of these perturbation gadgets. The point is, usually, if you say, well, let's look at, if I make this the perturbation, what is my effective Hamiltonian, which I can calculate using perturbation theory, I may get some additional terms that I didn't want to, because I want to get only this term. So I need to deal with them. And this is like my V extra. So there's some things I have to put in that make sure that comes, you know, that I get the right term, and I have to make sure that the Earth, there's extra, it should be extra. Okay, so now why? What is the intuition? Why this type of thing is the right thing? That is the question. That's what, in order to construct a perturbative gadget, a perturbation gadget, you have to get an intuition about how this perturbation theory works. Now, my target Hamiltonian, I said I have to do a unitary transformation on H, but I can perturbatively expand this in terms of commutators and double commutators. And then I have to project onto this ground space. Yeah? And what happens is that if I project onto this ground, so I start basically here in the ground space, I apply H or S, I may get out of the ground state. Yeah? Because if I apply V, I get out of the ground state. And at the end here with P0, I have to get back in. So the intuition, which maybe is hard to capture very briefly, is that in first order perturbations here, I'm not getting anything, because I only get a term that gets you out of the ground state, but I have to be back in. In second order perturbation theory, there's a term that gets you out, maybe by applying also minus A, and a term that gets you back in by applying B. And if I do that, then I've applied minus A tensor B. So that's the term that I want to get. So that is a little bit the intuition, but then, you know, if you do technically, you can expand this S, and you can see that it's, you get A tensor B. But this, I don't think you can, okay, so you have to write this as a double commutator, and you see which terms are you're still there in, you know, lowest order. And you see that these terms are of the form minus A plus B, you know, is a square, and you cancel off this term, and then you remain something like this. Okay. But you can see there's it's like a trick, and once you understand maybe the trick, you can apply this quite widely, or at least it has been shown to be very widely applicable and to relate many models of physics to each other. So a Bose-Hubbard model with something else, or fermionic-Hubbard model. Okay, so this is what I want to say about perturbation gadgets. And now I want to really switch. Is there any questions maybe now? Yes.
You might think from the way you discussed it that you can only make a small change to H naught. Is the point that everything is low energy, so even something?
Well, this all is low energy, and this is all degenerate.
But the difference between your original and your...
The thing is, it's a matter of scales. I define a new Hamiltonian, which has such a large scale, which is this delta is much larger than my the Hamiltonian I start with, my H target. So my target Hamiltonian I want to generate has some energy scale. And I'm saying I'm going to define a new Hamiltonian, which has a much bigger, wider spectrum, such that only the low-line spectrum, you know, captures this H target. So it's really the reverse of what you usually do. Does this answer your question?
I think, well, it's consistent with what I was thinking.
Okay. Okay, other questions? Okay, it's a bit of a technical subject, which is, but I do want to make clear that it's this such a systematic approach, which I think is quite nice. Okay, so because the point is that the classification that I'm going to say near the end, is only possible if we have these perturbation gadgets. Like I said, I don't know any other method to doing this. Okay, so now I said I want to talk about computational complexity, and we're going to do that in terms of a game. And the game is this. So the game is that there is a person called Merlin. Well, so the game is somebody has to solve problems, and the problem solver is Arthur. And Arthur is an earthling, is somebody like us, which has a limited computational power. So if he has to solve a problem, and the problem is specified with n bits, he can use at most some circuit which uses polynomial number of in n gates. I'm not specifying whether it's a quantum circuit or a classical circuit, but he has to use resources that scale polynomially with the problem that he has to solve. Yeah? But in this game, he's not all by himself. He could try to solve this problem himself, and that's doing efficient computation and solving the problem. But in this game, he actually can get help from Merlin. And the way you can have the different models, you can say, well, maybe he can interact multiple times with Merlin, keep asking him questions and so on. But in the game I'm going to specify now, he's allowed to interact with Merlin once. Basically, Merlin gives him something. He's not even asking for it. He just gives him something. There's no, there's no communication. Of course, Merlin knows what problem he has to solve. But Merlin, he has unlimited computational power. We don't care about how he does his computation, but assume that he can figure out everything. But he is not necessarily to be trusted. So if he says, Arthur has to solve a problem, and Merlin says, oh, the answer is yes, then of course this is not very convincing. Yes? Because why would Arthur trust Merlin on this? Yeah? So Arthur should be able to do some computation by which he can be convinced, that whatever Merlin gives him is actually correct. Okay, so what are the problems that Arthur wants to solve? Well, you probably, maybe I'm phrasing something that you already know, because you know probably about NP and so on. I'm phrasing it in a slightly different way to make this setting more general. So for example, Arthur has to solve the problem. I'm given an integer n, an integer p, which is less than n, And I'm specifying these integers with log n bits, and I have to decide whether n has a prime factor less than p. And the answer is the answer I have to say is yes or no. Okay, so now how can Merlin help? Merlin could give him a prime factor less than p, if it exists. And of course, Merlin would have a very hard time giving a prime factor less than p if it doesn't exist. And it would be quite clear for Arthur that, you know, if he's given this integer, that, you know, he can verify whether it is a factor of n. Yeah? Right? He can just, he can verify this efficiently. So another problem is, for example, Arthur has to solve the problem. He has he's looked for n bits. He's given some constraints on some number of bits. Yeah? And these constraints are the following form. There's a constraint number one, which is some OR function of these bits or their negation. And the idea is that the question is there a value for these bits such that this thing will evaluate to one? Well, if take x1 as 1, then it's clear it can be evaluated to 1. But I don't just have one constraint. I have many of these constraints. Yeah? So the problem that Arthur has to solve, can I find values for these bits, x1 to xn, which satisfy all these constraints? That's the three-set problem. And so again, Merlin can help by just simply giving him, if it exists, bit values x1 to xn, which satisfy the constraints. And you can see that it's quite simple for Arthur to verify that these bits satisfy this. That's not a hard thing. The problem is to find these bits in the first place. So in general, this help from Arthur, we say that this help from Arthur has to be complete and sound. This is a bit of a technical thing, but what it really means is that if we say that, you know, Arthur can solve this with a classical circuit, he has to be able to do that for every possible problem of this type, for this, you know, where these constraints are given by these, functions of three variables. And so this it shouldn't be that for some problems Arthur says, I don't have a proof, I can't convince you. Of course, the thing is the proof has to be complete. That's to say, if the answer is yes, one can find an assignment, that he should be able to give you the assignment or give you a proof that the assignment exists. Yeah? And what Arthur then does, of course, is that if Merlin gives him something else, something that's not convincing, he says, okay, the answer is no. And so Merlin's trying to convince Arthur that the answer is yes, Arthur is verifying. So the proof, the thing that Merlin gives, has to be sound, meaning that it cannot fool Arthur, that Arthur can really verify. And so Merlin can give you other bits, but of course, there's no way of convincing Arthur that they satisfy the constraints if they don't, because Arthur can just verify this. Okay, so very natural extension of such a classical problem is the problem of determining whether a Hamiltonian what is the ground state energy of a Hamiltonian? In the following way, we have Arthur now is given a Hamiltonian, which is a sum of terms. It acts on n qubits, and each one of them acts on order 1 qubit, so I can efficiently describe this. He just gets each one of these terms with their, you know, coupling strengths all described in certain number of bits. We say it's all described by polynomial number of bits. That's the problem size. He's also given a bound E, sort of an energy bound, also given a certain number of bits. And the problem he has to solve, is there a state for this Hamiltonian? Is there a state potentially an energy eigenstate with energy less than E? Okay, so in this case, let's play the game that Merlin can give him a quantum state. And so in these cases, it's sort of clear that he could consider the fact that he's given a quantum state, but it's not necessary. So here it may be clear that if Merlin can give you a quantum state, namely, Merlin can give you a state which has very low energy. And so the task then for Arthur is to check, to calculate, or to estimate the energy of that state. Okay, now this can be done efficiently if Arthur has a quantum circuit. He cannot calculate this energy with arbitrary precision. He can only calculated with some polynomial precision. Okay, but maybe you're willing to believe me. I'm not going to specify how he does this, but that this verification of this energy can be done efficiently. Okay, so now so in this last case, I said Merlin or Arthur has a quantum circuit because he has to process this quantum state. So now we can start doing some classification because we can play this game in different ways. And the differences between these classes and the ways we play the game are only differences in terms of what Arthur can do. Merlin, in all cases, can give actually Arthur a quantum state. But it's just that, if Arthur is purely doing classical computation, he can get a quantum state, but it's not going to help him. In the case of the class NP, which means that all the problems that Arthur can solve with the help of Merlin, that's the class NP, if Arthur uses a classical circuit. Okay, so how can we extend this? Well, in this first case with NP, we really require that Arthur has to solve a problem, you know, is there a prime factor less than P or something? The answer is yes or no. We require here that Arthur, if the answer is yes, he answers yes with certainty. If the answer is no, he answers no with certainty. That means solving the problem. He's not allowed to make a small mistake. But you can extend this a little bit and say, well, maybe Arthur can run a randomized algorithm. He has some random bits, and he runs a classical circuit. But because he has random bits, if the answer is yes, you know, his randomized circuit will output yes with probability which is very close to 1, but not quite 1. And that we could relax that a little bit. And actually, in this class MA, the probability that you get a 1 is really exponentially close to 1. And if the answer is no, the probability of 1 can be made exponentially close to 0. Yes, so this is, you know, for all, it's very practical. Now, I will mention this in a moment, but the other thing, which is sort of natural, if we say, well, okay, so we know classical computation, but now what about quantum computation? So now we say Arthur runs a quantum circuit. Yeah? So proof by Merlin principle is the same, but we only say Arthur runs a quantum circuit, and again, he's allowed to make a small probability of error. And there is also now, there is another class, which is called stochastic Arthur, which is somewhere, and I'll define that in a moment. Okay, so what is the difference between these classes? Well, in going from here to there, Arthur is given more and more power, right? Because he can decide a larger class of problems. I haven't defined the stochastic Arthur, but you understand that the quantum circuit is equally powerful as a classical circuit, so he can also solve the problems in NP, so that is, as a consequence, the problem he can solve in NP is contained in all the problems he can solve in QMA. And the problems he can solve in MA is larger, and stochastic MA is even larger. There's a hierarchy like this. Okay, so, yes. So now, what I want to do in the remaining of the talk is to So these classes, so I have the NP, MA, and stochastic MA and QMA, they can all be associated with Hamiltonians, with three types of Hamiltonians. And maybe not surprisingly, for the classical class, these are classical Hamiltonians. For the stochastic class, these are stochastic or sign-free Hamiltonians. For the quantum class, they're fully quantum Hamiltonians. Okay, I want to define what stochastic Arthur is, and I never dared to talk about this class before, because it's kind of a weird object. And the reason I decided to talk about it now is because of some recent results that show this class is actually quite relevant. Okay, so what is the verification circuit? What's the circuit that Arthur runs if he is stochastic? Okay, so let's think about a classical circuit that uses random bits. Okay, so a classical circuit that uses random bits is something which takes in the proof by Merlin, which is some arbitrary quantum state. And it takes in some random bits. Now, how do I model random bits? I can make them a little bit more quantum looking, I replace them by plus states. So if I were to measure these right away, then I just random, the old red bits that come out to be 0 or 1 is probably 10. And there's some workspace that he has. These are ancilla set to 0. And there's the problem he wants to solve. And he could run a classical circuit. And if we're talking about MA, or classical randomized computation, at the end of the circuit, he just looks at a few of those bits, or one of those bits, and that whether that bit is 0 or 1 will decide his problem. If it's 0, he says the answer is yes. If it's 1, he says the answer is no. That's the way he does that for randomized computation. And now we make one change for to get stochastic computation. For stochastic, we make one little change. Is instead of at the end he measures a bit, he also measures a bit, but in the Hadamard basis, so in the rotated basis. So he does a Hadamard transformation, which maps poly X and poly C, and then measure the qubit. It looks completely harmless and not making any difference, but it actually turns out to make some difference. And this is sort of a weird thing. So he measures, instead of measuring, there's one qubit out, and he measures this qubit in this basis, plus minus basis. And now we also modify slightly what he does with that answer. So we define this, and this is maybe a little bit technical. We say he decides yes if the probability to get outcome plus is larger than some bound epsilon yes. And he decides no if this probability is less than epsilon no. And the only guarantee is that these are separated by 1 over polynomial, 1 over poly n amount. Now, this is not a very practical way of deciding this problem, because Arthur runs this circuit, and he just measures this qubit once. If there's just only this guarantee, he's not learning much from that bit. So you shouldn't think about this as a way of really solving this problem for Arthur, but more as a formal definition of this class. Because it's actually, we don't know, we can say, well, okay, can he do this again? Maybe he's done this once, and then why can he not measure more than one qubit? Or have a lot of output qubits? Well, it turns out that we need to define this class in order to make contact with sign-free or stochastic Hamiltonians. It's very natural. It doesn't look natural, but there's no other way we can do it yet.
There's this class QMA plus that lets you do, like, to have multiple registers and then estimate the probability of success.
This is not with multiple proofs, right?
No, so it says that, like, if you want to, if you have some probability of success and you want to ensure that that's above or below a threshold, you can do that in QMA. So what I'm wondering is,
yes,
if this class admits the same sort of thing?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't thought about this. Yeah. It could be. I mean, yeah. I don't know how to amplify this, but okay, maybe we should talk about it. Yeah. Okay, so now this was maybe a bit painful. It's like, why does she define it this way? It's not very pleasant. But I want to come back to this computational complexity, because I want to give you the overview of why we do play this game. Because, so NP is a class of problems that sort of Arthur can solve with her help of Merlin, in which Arthur runs a classical circuit. And there are many problems in NP. And what we want to do is to say, can we encode all these problems in one big problem? So there's the master problem. Well, there are more than one master problem, but one problem, and this is what is called NP complete. And so determining the ground state energy of an Ising model spin glass, where I'm allowed to choose these couplings to be ferromagnetic, antiferromagnetic, or zero, and I also have a local field which I can turn off and off, that captures all problems in NP. So if I have any problem in NP, like this prime vectorization or this three set, I can give you an explicit rewriting of the problem such that it becomes the Ising model spin glass. Yeah, so if you can solve that problem, by some means, you could for any type, any set of couplings, you could solve all these other problems. Now, of course, we don't believe we can solve without help of Merlin all these problems in MP. Yeah? But at least it's nice to say we can capture all these problems in one problem, yeah? To show what captures the class. Yeah.
Does it mean it's two-dimensional rectangular?
Yeah, this is can be assumed to be two-dimensional. Yes, but you do need, of course, if you don't have this, it's actually not. It's a simple problem. You need, it can be two-dimensional, yes.
And it's nearest, not, nearest neighbor.
Nearest neighbor interactions, yeah. So now, yeah, you see here, of course, you'd like this master problem to be as simple as possible, right? Because that is the best, you know, way of capturing this class. So you say, well, yeah, of course, if an arbitrary, this is on an arbitrary graph, it's easier, but maybe I can rewrite it as a problem on two dimensions. And you can do that, and there's an old result by Barahona, which has done, who did this.
The size of the lattice corresponds to the...
The size of the problem, exactly. Yes, yeah.
Linear way or something.
Yeah, yes, yeah. Now, for QMA, you can also do this. And the way you do this, you actually find, now you ask about the ground state energy of a quantum Hamiltonian. And the first problem you prove to be QMA complete, that captures this QMA, is a weird five local Hamiltonian with interaction structure, which has nothing to do with the 2D lattice. Now, how do you get from that Hamiltonian to something physical, something nice? Well, you know the answer, right? Using the perturbation gadgets. That's the way you can, because what is hard about this Hamiltonian is to determine the ground state energy with a certain accuracy. So if I have a new Hamiltonian for which I have a guarantee, and which is simpler, but I have a guarantee that the ground state energy of that new Hamiltonian is very close to the one of which I've already proved something, I can say, well, then that new Hamiltonian, that deciding the ground state energy of that new Hamiltonian must also be hard. So that's a way, so for these quantum Hamiltonians, this is only an example. You can show that the complexity, you know, that you can encode any problem in QMA in a Heisenberg model. But you can also do it in a one-dimensional quantum Hamiltonian, even in a one-dimensional system. So this, I'm not sure the Heisenberg model and the one-dimensional, I guess, yeah, you can do that too, probably. But these steps all use perturbation theory. All this, or at least we don't know. I mean, there's some steps that don't, but it's okay. Now, why stochastic MA? Now you already see this. It turns out that for this weird class that I defined, that what can all the problems that are in stochastic MA we can capture by the transverse field Ising model. Now, that's we had shown before that all the problems in stochastic MA could be captured by some class of Hamiltonians that had no sign problem. I'll talk about what I mean by the sign problem in a moment. And there's a recent result by Brafi and Hastings, which have six layers of perturbation gadgets. It's a horrible construction. It reduces any stochastic Hamiltonians via the Bose-Hubbard model, blah, 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 to a transverse field Ising model. But it does work, and it shows that all these problems can be captured in this. And so you see that you know, those are, of course, models we study in physics. You say, well, why, you know, it's not maybe surprising, because these capture the sort of computational power of these different classes. Okay, but there's many results that have gone into this classification, so they're still being obtained. So what I want to do now, Okay, so I have to define what I mean by stochastic. So I defined a weird class with stochastic MA, but what is the feature of the transverse field Ising model that makes it different from a Heisenberg model? And people doing you know, numerics and quantum Monte Carlo know this very well, the transverse field Ising model and many models in physics, they don't have a sign problem. So what does it mean? Now, so a stochastic, maybe we should have just called these sign-free Hamiltonians. And so in general, a Hamiltonian is some Hermitian matrix. But what is a stochastic Hamiltonian? We say it's a Hamiltonian which is real. Okay, that's a small restriction. But there's a further constraint. We take a favorite basis. It has to be some product basis. And we say that this Hamiltonian, if we look at this Hamiltonian as a big matrix in this basis, on the off diagonal, the elements, matrix elements, have to be non-positive. Okay. So let's look at some examples. Why is this kind of natural? Okay, so I have quantum mechanics. What is quantum mechanics? Simple, one single particle. I have a kinetic energy and a potential energy. My basis is my position basis. And it's clear that the kinetic energy, because of this sign, is negative and it's off diagonal. Right? This is just a diagonal term in this basis. So that's stochastic, that's by definition. Bose-Hubbard model. Also stochastic ferromagnetic interactions, also stochastic, you have to pick your, it's basis dependent, but you can allow some local unitary rotation so that if it's stochastic under that rotation, you call it stochastic. That it doesn't change the complexity. The transverse field Ising model, which I just discussed, is a good example of stochastic, because what we have is we have these ZZ interactions, which are diagonal interactions. And then we have a transverse field, which is off diagonal. Now, it doesn't necessarily come with a plus or minus sign, but I can always do, I can always multiply, do a rotation by Z, and I can always make this non-positive. James Cummings model, which I discussed, Spinoza models, the D-Wave company, which I come to an end, because actually this was all motivated by D-Wave. This company that tries to make an adiabatic quantum computer, that the fact that their Hamiltonian was actually didn't have to have the sign problem, which makes it easy to simulate now by Matthias Stroyer and all that. They all use quantum Monte Carlo to, well, they simulate this transverse field Ising model by quantum Monte Carlo, of course. Anyhow, but so stochastic Hamiltonians are ubiquitous, but they are not the most general things. And I actually think there is a relation, but I haven't made this rigorous, with time reversal symmetry. So if this time reversal symmetry is broken, it's not stochastic. And so, but I don't, I actually have to, I shouldn't say anything about it because I haven't, we haven't captured these Hamiltonians that far. We only talk about systems with the stochastic Hamiltonians we derive or we define properly for systems of qubits and a certain, you know, qubit basis, which is a product basis, and then we this rigorously define. Okay, so why are these Hamiltonians special? Okay, so I said stochastic Hamiltonians are real, they have non-positive off-diagonal elements in some standard basis. Now there's a very simple property that follows from this. And basically, I can show you here, the ground state, we're only interested in ground state for this whole thing. The ground state is a vector in this specific basis such that its coefficients are non-negative. In general, they are complex or, you know, alternating minus one, plus one, right? And so you can actually relate, so the one other way of saying it, if you have the Hamiltonian H, you can relate it to a non-negative matrix. So you say, okay, I do identity minus TH, and T is some small parameter, such that on the diagonal, everything is positive. So I make T small enough such that the diagonal is positive. And on the off-diagonal, H was negative, so it becomes positive if I take identity minus TH. So G is a non-negative matrix, and there's a Poisson-Frobenius theorem that says that the largest eigenvector of a non-negative matrix has non-negative coefficients. And similarly, the Gibbs matrix is a non-negative matrix, and that's used in quantum Monte Carlo, because you take the Gibbs matrix, you squeeze it between basis elements, and it's just some non-negative weight, and it's not a complex thing. Okay, so the difference between Hamiltonians, the difference between stochastic Hamiltonians and general Hamiltonians is only captured in the ground state properties. No? But of course, for this classification in terms of, you know, computational complexity, we're interested in the ground state. We're interested in the ground state energy. Okay, so how are we doing on my time? Yeah. Now I want to I want to say one thing, which is very technical, and maybe people will not be so interested in this, but I think because I defined this stochastic verifier in a in a way that you say, well, where's this coming from? And what I want to show is that why can a stochastic Arthur solve this ground state problem for a signed-free Hamiltonian with a circuit? This is not trivial. I mean, I think it's not trivial. Right? So I have a Hamiltonian which has no sign problem. Now, what does that do? And I say he doesn't need to run a quantum circuit. He can run a classical circuit and do this weird measurement. And now with this weird measurement, it shouldn't be that, you know, the answer for plus is 1. In one case, the answer for plus is, you know, he should have some separation. Okay, so he has to determine whether the ground state energy is less than A or larger than A plus 1 over poly N. That's the problem he has to solve. And the claim is that that problem maps onto the probability for plus being larger than some A or smaller than some A minus 1 over poly N. Roughly, not the same A necessarily, but there's a 1 over poly N separation. And this is not obvious because somehow he has to use the circuit to measure the energy of this Hamiltonian. And in general, you do this with the quantum circuit. So how does he do this here? Okay, so this is technical, so you can, you know, if you don't want to hear this, this is fine. So so there are two tricks that we use actually here. So I have a Hamiltonian H. And I'm going to add take some prefactor and add some identity. And so it uses there two tricks. One is this lemma 2. And the claim is this. I can write a stochastic Hamiltonian. I can write in this way, which is a sum over pj, where pj are probabilities. And this uj, hj, uj dagger is a Hamiltonian. And this uj is a quantum circuit that Arthur can apply. So the idea is a little bit, this is like a convex combination of things that Arthur can do. So he needs some randomness. So Arthur's going to pick some randomness. He has random bits. And with those random bits, he's going to pick a J. You know, he's going to simulate this probability. And he's going to pick, you know, he has to measure this, right? So he can measure this by saying, well, okay, if this is a convex combination of terms, I generate one of those terms with the correct probability, and I'm going to measure that term. That's the procedure he's going to do. And in order to measure that term, what's that term? That term is actually a quantum circuit that he can measure that term by applying the quantum circuit uj. That's a simple circuit with control with x and c naught k. It's a classical circuit. And this hj, what is that? That's a measurement. It's an observable, which is measure a lot of qubits in the zero, you know, as zeros or something like this. Okay, so that's technical. And this doesn't look like, you know, he's not given. He cannot measure these observables, right? Because he can only measure in the plus minus spaces. So there's two steps. One is just saying we reduce it to, we write this Hamiltonian plus some identity as this, where these are observables. And now there's a next step in which I have to show you how these observables can be measured using his circuit. So let's first now look at why this would be true. I'll give you some intuition. Now, we're going to look at one. So we have a Hamiltonian which is k-local and stochastic. Now let's look at one term. Now, what does it mean? We say that so we add some identities to it to make all the matrix elements negative. We can always do that, right? Because we can add an identity on the diagonal, make it all negative. So such a operator looks kind of like this. It's real, and all the matrix elements are negative, right? That's one term. So this is only on k qubits, and r x y is negative. Now, what the only thing I want to do is I want to rewrite my x and y. So there's some x and y, and I can take, there's some circuit, there's some classical circuit that maps, you know, k zeros onto x, and maps y onto k minus 1 zeros and 1. It's just a relabeling of x and y. I can do that for one such term. And if I do that, if I put that in, that's this unitary, I can rewrite this as, well, there's a diagonal term, which is Rxx. And here then you see, this is then, you know, projector onto k qubits which are zero. And here I get an x. Okay, maybe this goes a bit too fast, but the, so this I can do for a single term. And here I have this Rxy is negative, so I can pull that into these observables because they're negative here. And I can massage this in terms of that these become probabilities because they're just non-negative then, right? Because I've taken out this overall minus sign. Okay, so that's step one. The step one is that this is true. Yeah? So step one is saying that if I want to measure the energy of this, I have to generate some J with probability PJ and then measure this observable, which I can do by running the circuit corresponding to UJ and measuring these observables, one of these. Now, how do I measure these observables with my plus? Okay, so here is some, this is the next intuition. So I'm not going to show you the details, but let's imagine, okay, so what he has to measure is an observable like this. A projector onto k qubits being zero, or one qubit being x, and k minus one qubits. I'm going to show you, or at least argue, that I want to, how can we measure this guy, the projector onto zero? Now, first of all, note what he can do. The probability for being plus can be related, of course, to the expectation value of this observable x. So if he can, so you can say, well, let's imagine he can measure x, this observable. So now there is a circuit which says, let's imagine we can measure this. We can do this measurement on some state psi. If we have two ancilla, zero plus, and a Toffoli gate, and measure x on plus. So the claim is this: I have my state psi, and I want to look at the expectation value of this projector onto that state. What's that equal to? I'm claiming it's the same as having in addition an ancilla zero and plus, doing a Toffoli gate on them, and measuring or looking at the expectation of the observable x on that plus state. Okay, just a little circuit. So that's the circuit. Okay, so maybe, I'm not sure I'm willing to believe, but do people want to know why? And they, you know, actually was preparing this talk and said, well, how can it be? Because this has trace zero and this is trace one. So how can it be? But you're measuring this not on, you know, you have an ancilla in which you do this. So trace is not measured. But this thing shows it. Okay, so this is not, so the reason why I wanted to throw this in is because this is hidden in this paper. And it's actually not so, I think it's not trivial to actually show that if you have a stochastic Hamiltonian, you can measure this energy with this circuit. And you measure it in the following way. If the energy is larger than, say, A, the probability for plus will be larger than something. And if the energy is lower than A minus 1 over poly n, the energy, the probability for plus will be, you know, 1 over poly n lower. So there's the idea is there's a polynomial separation. Okay, now, okay, maybe I've already chased a few people away here, but the reason why I find stochastic MA interesting and why we defined this was actually not to throw in yet another complexity class. It was to know what is the power of quantum annealing. Because what is quantum annealing? It's I have my transverse field Ising model. And I gradually change the strength of the transverse field and hope that gaps don't close, and I want to do some computation with it. So what it's kind of like, it's, you know, it's Arthur all by himself, right? There's no Merlin that can help. And you want to capture, you want to know whether that process, if you run it perfectly, has any computational power beyond classical computation. And our thought was that that probably was not going to be the case. So whatever D-wave, the claim or the idea was, and now actually I think it's much more subtle, whatever D-wave is doing, it's very noisy, but if we know it's only stochastic or it's only quantum annealing, and I can and I can relate, you know, and I can prove that that's just the same as classical computation, then, you know, we don't care about this machine, right? Whether or not gaps are closing at all, right? It's just that if the gaps don't close and I can still prove it can be classically simulated, I don't need to go on with this. But the, so this is why we started looking at this question, in fact, and came up with this question, okay, so what, you know, what is special about stochastic Hamiltonians, and what is special about it if we ask not how we use them for equanimous annealing, but if we ask how we use them for, I mean, if we ask about their ground state properties, you know, we want to determine their ground state energy. And we've seen that that problem is in stochastic MA, and I can only tell you that stochastic MA is believed to be equal to MA, is believed to be equal to NP, whereas QMA is different. But that by itself does not prove that quantum annealing can be classically simulated. Because Arthur gets help from Merlin, so that can give him, it can obliterate the power that he would have if he had was by himself. So it could be that quantum annealing gives you gives him still an edge over classical computation, but if he were given, you know, he gives power, gets power from Merlin, that little edge would just be not visible and all these classes would be the same. Okay, so that remains, I think, a very big open problem, and I hope that with trying to do these things and trying to cut Merlin off, it's giving a, you know, Merlin gives you a log n proof or something like that, you can play these games, is a way of getting to this question. What's the power of quantum annealing? Okay, I think I'd like to leave it at that.
The reasoning for why MA should be the same as NP is pretty simple. Right? That, you know, Arthur should be able to generate random bits using like a pseudorandom number generator.
Yes.
So is there a similar reason for why?
Well, we have proved also that stochastic MA is in AM. So AM is a class, and that uses estimating the partition function of the stochastic Hamiltonian. So AM is a class by which there's some more interaction between Arthur and Merlin. So first, Arthur sends a random string to Merlin, sort of like a challenge, and then Merlin responds. And it's believed that AM is equal to AMA is equal to NP. Yeah.
So for these perturbation theory gadgets, there's this problem that you have to have this big separation of energy scales.
Yes.
So do you have any
prospects
for?
Yes,
that?
I mean, I think there's it's sort of it's inevitable. I don't think it's something where there's like, well, it's inevitable, but you also can go around it in a different way. I mean, it's, you know, if you'd have a Hamiltonian, let's say I had a Hamiltonian which is a sum of, you know, disconnected parts, and for every part I have some complicated Hamiltonian I'm going to replace by something simpler, then for every such transformation I make a little error epsilon, then of course my overall error that I make in my ground state energy will be epsilon times the number of parts in my Hamiltonian. So it scales, if the number of parts is n, scales with n. So if I want that epsilon times n to be very small, then I need my epsilon to scale as 1 over n. So, and therefore, my local gadget that replace, or my local trick that doesn't work, only works on the part, should have an accuracy that scales with the total system size. Now, that so this is similar. That if I have a gate, if I have a circuit which has many gates, and I want it to have a very high accuracy, it has n gates, and every one of them is has error epsilon, then I have a total error epsilon times n. And then you say, how am I going to do fault tolerant computation if I have that? Well, then you say, well, it's you have to use error correction, right? So you say, I shouldn't try to do every gate with error, you know, 1 over n, because I can't physically do that. I need to have a trick. So for every local thing, I need to use redundancy in something else. So that's what I meant by fault tolerant perturbation gadgets. One needs to, well, and I don't know how this works, but I don't think the perturbation theory is not at fault. It's just more the, we ask to get the ground state energy with a very high accuracy, We cannot avoid this problem. But instead of really immediately going to a system with n things, we should say, we have one gadget which replaces one term. How we can get that accuracy very high by having a lot of overhead of using some error correction. But of course, we don't know how to do this quite.
In the end, I didn't understand the connection between D-Wave, I take it, is this commercial
claim
quantum computer. What is its connection to quantum annealing, and what do they claim?
Okay, sorry,
and
yes.
What are you possibly debunking?
Yes, so D-Wave is running, so D-Wave has some superconducting qubits, which are flux qubits, and it's basically running these superconducting qubits. They are set, their coupling is set such that you realize this model, and that they hope that, because they're low temperature and so on, that you're in the ground state of this model, or sorry, not this model, this model. And they actually, for in their case, they can't play with these couplings. They have one field, and they gradually change this over time. So they start in a situation where this is very large, and the state is very simple, and then they gradually change it so that at the end of the day, this is zero, and you have a model like that, which encodes a hard computational problem. And they hope that while they do that, this is a gradual adiabatic change of the Hamiltonian, that they stay in the ground state. And the point is that so they and that that's process called quantum annealing. And so the question is, there are other adiabatic computations for which you can show that they represent real quantum computations. But you can ask whether quantum annealing, this particular process, whether you can do source factoring that way. And I think you cannot, and because there are these different classes. It's really a separate powers, and that's what this classification makes somewhat more clear. Does this answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I guess, just as a related question,
mm-hmm.
Isn't it true that people say no one knows for sure that all these classes don't collapse? Is that right?
Well, so I think QMA is not believed to be in NP. I mean, NP and P, we don't know whether they're the same. There are many open questions, but there are also strong beliefs. So, for example, why is QMA? So stochastic MA and NP are probably all the same, but QMA is not equal to NP. Or at least not believed to be, because there are problems that are in BQP. BQP captures everything that quantum computers can do. So the problems that are the hardest problems for a quantum, the problems that capture the class of quantum computation are not known to be in NP. Right? So there are.
But we don't know for sure.
Well, we don't know. I mean, yes, we don't know. But I mean, it doesn't seem like there's. Because all these things are beliefs, but there are,
But modulo those beliefs, then you, which everyone believes. So.
Right. Well, I think these beliefs are, it's fair to deal with these beliefs, I think. And also some things I can also believe what the power of quantum annealing is, but then I think it's really not the very deep thing, right? I mean, these are fairly widely held beliefs.